Hello! Welcome back to the Victory Kitchen. How many times do you access your freezer every day? Do you use it to store a lot of food? I don't know about you, but I heavily rely on my freezer for short-term and long-term storage of foods. I'm especially partial to frozen vegetables, and who doesn't like to have a quart of ice cream on standby? But imagine a time before this freezer space in your home wasn't available, where the only place to store a good deal of frozen food was at a communally shared building called a freezer locker plant. In this episode, we'll be learning about this little-known technology that has fallen out of use. The questions we'll be answering are, what were freezer locker plants? How did they serve their communities? And the greater war food problem? And were they really as patriotic a solution to food preservation as they claimed? Let's dig in and find out. Welcome to the Victory Kitchen, the podcast all about American food rationing during World War II. I'm your host, Sarah Creviston Lee, author, historian, and vintage foodie. I'll be exploring the logistics of food rationing, featuring wartime cookbooks and recipes, and highlighting real homefront experiences. We're going to be learning exactly what our grandmothers had to do to get their food to fight for victory. I am very excited about this topic. Do I say that about every topic? Well, this particular topic about freezer locker plants is one of the original ideas I had written down when I was planning my podcast 3.5 years ago. So I'm finally getting around to it. The reason why I'm so excited, well, one reason is because I actually wrote my undergraduate capstone paper on the beginning of the frozen food industry in America in the late 1930s. So I've always wanted to revisit this topic and, you know, recycle some of my college research because how fun, but also to look a bit further down the road into World War II. I had come across mentions of locker plants in my research in college, but they weren't as vital to my paper, so I set that info aside. It always remained in the back of my thoughts, though, because it sounded like a really cool topic to learn about. So that's what we're going to be doing today. So first, we're going to kind of look at the freezing technology pre-World War II. Pre-1930s, frozen food actually had kind of a bad connotation. It usually meant food that was frostbitten or inedible. When Clarence Birdseye launched his line of 26 frozen foods on March 6, 1930, he coined the term frosted foods to help change public opinion about eating frozen foods. It was a pretty risky time to launch a new type of food into the market so soon after the stock market crash of 1929. And to further help things along, he put into action an education campaign to teach consumers how to use these new frozen food products. But through this careful plan, he slowly succeeded, and frozen food gained popularity in cities where it was available. It wasn't available everywhere. The idea of having fresh-tasting foods out of season is pretty alluring, like raspberries or peas or cherries. Of course, frosted foods weren't available everywhere, especially in rural areas, where taking frozen packages home was impractical. So this sets the backdrop for the whole frozen food idea in American culture. So moving on to the technology. You know, by the 1930s, if a household had a refrigerator, the freezer compartment was relatively small, especially compared to our modern fridge freezer space. They could keep ice cube trays in there, maybe a pint of ice cream, and had space to make frozen desserts, but it wasn't really a space to store frozen food long term. And a lot of homes still use those ice boxes with blocks of ice where they did not have electricity. Now, grocery stores had freezer chests that they could rent, usually from the Birdseye Company, and it would be filled with that product only. A Birdseye employee would stock the chest. If a grocer was caught putting his own contraband and not true quick frozen product in the chest freezer, they'd lose the contract and the cabinet. From ads I've seen, a grocery store could probably purchase their own freezer chest, but stocking it with product would be a difficult task without a frozen foods or local producer. So, what were freezer lockers, and how did freezer locker plants come about in the American food landscape? What were freezer locker plants? These were large buildings with big freezer rooms, and they had lockers from larger size down to small freezer drawers that the public could rent for a minimal yearly fee where they could store their specially packaged frozen foods. In a newspaper article, The Record from New Jersey, dated 19th of April, 1944, it says, Roy Tice, first man in Bergen County to install a freezer locker plant for use by the public, just turned the amazing room inside out for you. He showed you the plaster-finished 14-inch walls of granulated cork and pointed out the intricate system of pipes extended from the ceiling that will constantly keep the room at an even sub-zero temperature. The lockers are 6 by 7 cubic feet, he explained. They tier up to a height of 11 feet, and because the top lockers aren't easy to get to, I'm renting them for less. The handy ones go for $18 a year. If you've ever seen the Dyma Locker luggage storage spaces in the railroad stations, you know what these look like. So that's kind of a good illustration of the lockers that people had to be able to rent. Now, lockers were made from various materials. In one article, it mentions porcelain, and when they ran out of those, they constructed ones of wood. And since they were blocked by, and then during the war, since they were blocked by the war's steel shortage, they had to wait until after the war to begin constructing steel lockers. In the magazine American Builder from June 1943, there was an article featuring a frozen food locker plant in Alexander City, Alabama, that was built for Russell Mills, a cotton textile manufacturer. It was the first instance known where an industry had taken this step to encourage meat production by its employees, many of whom lived on small acreage plots. What's fantastic about this article is that because it's a builder's magazine, it includes pictures of the entire layout of the locker plant with labels indicating where everything was. The lobby, the locker room, and its capacity of 505 lockers. The quick freezer room, the slaughter pen, poultry room, the work room, meat curing room, meat chill and aging room, a processing room, machine room, smoked meat storage, a dehydrating room, and bathrooms. And I am hoping to have the image of this in my Substack post, if possible, because when I first saw this, I was like, whoa, these are the actual plans for the locker plant. And it's hard to really imagine what it looked like on the inside, because as far as I know, like, I don't know if any of these locker plants still exist. I just like seeing, or at least knowing what they looked like on the inside. So these plans are pretty awesome to see. Now, you know, how did these freezer locker plants come about in the American food landscape? It says in the Durham Morning Herald from North Carolina in September of 1943 that the first refrigerated food lockers were used in 1903 on the Pacific coast and mostly remained popular in the western states. Most of the locker plants were west of the Mississippi until 1937. This article estimated that at that point in 1943, there were 3,000 freezer plants in the U.S. And I did run across various articles that had different numbers for different times, but I did not sit down and like sort all those out or like fact check them against each other. So I'm just going to take their word for it for now. In the featured cookbook for this episode, June Frost's recipe book, the introduction states that 10 years ago, there were no locker plants. 5 years ago, there were only a few hundred. Today, there are more than 4,500 in the United States, serving nearly 1.5 million patrons. You know, there's no publication date for this particular book, but it's possible that it was published in around 1944. And from what I could tell from the different articles, there was definitely a yearly increase in the amount of storage lockers available to the public. By wartime, the demand for freezer plants was on the rise. But because building materials were needed for the war effort, it took government approval and jumping through quite a few hoops in order for a community to get approval for the building of a freezer locker plant. I read an account of a grassroots effort that one community made to get a freezer locker plant built in their town. This is from the Hollis Post-Herald and the Sunday Times from Oklahoma, dated August 1943. And it talks about that there was a government allocation of a certain number of the plants throughout the country, so they were limiting them. It says, it was explained that before an application could be sent to Washington that not less than 180 people must indicate sufficient interest in having a plant located here to put up a deposit of not less than $8 And it was finally decided that a deposit of $10 be made, it being explained that the cost per member might be from $12.50 to $15 per year. It was stated in the meeting that 350 freezer food plants have been authorized over the country, and while it was not known definitely what number would be authorized in Oklahoma, it could not be many, and that it was imperative that any community wanting a plant should act quickly and get their application to the proper authorities in Washington. So you can see the sense of urgency, especially if Washington was limiting how many freezer locker plants were being built in a year because of, you know, building materials were scarce, how urgent it was for them to hurry and get their application in to the authorities so that they could get their community locker. Another form of government approval was found in 1944 in the Fort Payne Journal from Alabama. It said, in accordance with government regulations, it will be necessary for 60% of the capacity of this plant to be rented before the War Production Board will grant a priority for erecting it. The year's rent by each patron also had to be paid and was usually held in trust at a local bank in a special account until the plant was built. So who did these freezer locker plants serve? Who did they cater to? One were people who lived in the country and even those who lived in town. Two was hunters who wanted to freeze their big game because they did have some larger lockers. Those who hunted needed somewhere to store all that meat, and freezer lockers were a great place to do that. One article mentions in a caption below a photo of butchered deer, those with food reserves like these won't worry so much about points, meaning meat ration points. Also farmers and those with victory gardens, and then people who bought vegetables and meat in bulk. And fruits, when it was in season, to preserve when it was at its lowest price. In the Gaffney Ledger from South Carolina in 1944, it states, a study of the brief description of a freezer locker plant as outlined above will indicate very definite advantages to both farm families and families living in town. For families living in the country, it will mean that during the season of the year, when there is an abundance of fresh vegetables and fruits and meats, these products are kept fresh for use throughout the year at a very small cost. Then, too, it will mean that families living in the town will want to buy the surpluses of these products in order that they may put them in their lockers to be kept fresh for use throughout the year. For the families in town, such a plant will make possible buying of fresh products when they are plentiful, and the buying and processing of these materials in wholesale lots for future use. Another thing was that it was a community asset. It benefited the entire community. I came across a newspaper page from Homer, Louisiana, that had all of these ads from different companies congratulating the Claiborne Electric Refrigeration Cooperative Incorporated on establishing its new freezer locker plant and meat curing plant. The N.J. Kendrick Insurance Agency went so far as to fully recommend it in a large ad saying, some people are skeptical of a freezer locker, but they have heard of somebody else that did not like it. On the other hand, we have never heard a single person who has actually used a freezer locker, but what did not recommend it very highly. Therefore, we congratulate those who have made the freezer locker plant possible, and we recommend its use to those who need it. Another ad by Moreland's Grocery and Market stated warmly, we extend sincere congratulations to the Claiborne Electric Refrigeration Co-op, Incorporated. You are to be complimented on the establishment of this new service for the preservation and storage of vital food materials. We wish you the best of success. And on this page, there were 7 ads total wishing congratulations. I love that they were so supportive of another business and acknowledging what type of service they were offering the community. There was also a sense of community within the locker plants themselves. I read in the magazine Coronet, the January 43 issue, about locker plant bulletin boards with notes pinned to them. Farmer Jim Cobb in back of the Methodist Church has 2 acres of ripe melons he wants to sell quick. Or, Mrs. Sanders, or whoever reads this, if you're going to wholesale market this week, send up a crate of asparagus for me if you can get nice small ones, and they are still selling cheap. Busy with house guests, I'll do same for you. Mabel Hicks. I love that. Another thing I learned from this is I didn't realize they had wholesale markets that they could go and buy from. So it makes sense, though. and that's how they would get their inexpensive produce to freeze or can if they wanted to do it that way. And they didn't have a garden big enough to produce a lot of things for canning or, you know, food preservation. Now we're going to turn to freezing for the war effort. Why was freezing a better option than canning, and how did it help the war effort? Miss Gertrude Allen, the foods and nutrition specialist of the Kansas State College Extension Service, Manhattan, put it nicely. The use of freezer lockers preserves foods in a more natural state than any other method of storage. Which is very true. I mean, there have been studies, even modern studies, that have shown that fruits and vegetables and other food products that are frozen, like fresh ones that are frozen, retain their vitamin and mineral contents better than ones that have been canned. And also they have a better color as well. Another reason was that they used less glass, rubber, and sugar. In a Nebraska newspaper from February 1942, it says, "Frozen foods fit well into the war program. Indications are that cans and even glass jars will become scarce," also jar rubbers, "so that locker boxes will have to do extra duty. Also, freezing foods requires less sugar." When it came to packaging frozen foods, it was usually done in cardboard containers, which was more space efficient because they were all kind of a standardized size. And so that's where the that's what they're talking about, is that it's saved on the rubber, jar rubbers and the glass jars and cans. It also, freezing foods also helped with wartime transportation costs. In my June Frost's recipe book, it says, "Now in wartime, the locker plant is as important to the national economy as to that of the individual. By processing locally grown foods and making them available for later use in the community in which they are produced, the locker plant saves much transportation. By eliminating the hauling from the point of production to a distant processing center and back to the consumer. Two, because of locker plants, many foodstuffs that would otherwise be wasted are saved for use. In short, locker service saves the patron a good deal of money because it eliminates several profits incidental to the conventional methods of food distribution. And because it is possible for the user of food to buy in quantity with the assurance that quick freezing and low temperature storage will preserve with absolute safety." And most of the time, you know, if they're using a freezer locker plant, it's fairly close to them. So I thought this was a really important point, that they're keeping the food local and it's not having to be shipped somewhere and then shipped back, staying there and lessening waste. In the American Cookery magazine dated June-July 1942, it says, "Without doubt, the frozen food industry will take over part of the canner's job. Packing 1 million pounds of frozen peas in paper cellophane boxes instead of in standard metal cans means a saving of 265,158 pounds of sheet steel and 4,138 pounds of tin. Canning requires paper for labels and shipping cases. This brings the total packaging weight up to 404,189 pounds. The quick freezing method requires cellophane waxed paper, cartons, and shipping cases that add up to one-third of the can weight. The round can shipment requires the use of 64 freight cars, and the frozen food shipment, 31 cars proportionately." I love this because it gives the actual numbers that they've figured out, how much sheet metal cans take, plus their round size or shape does not help when it comes to being efficient with space. And so they're pointing out that these cellophane waxed paper cartons just stack nicely together and save an incredible amount on freight car needs, which if you've listened to my post, I mean, my episode about dining cars, I talk a little bit about how much stress was on the rail lines. And so this kind of gives you a good idea of how frozen food was helping to solve that problem. Frozen foods also kept foods local, like I mentioned before, and the prices down. Sometimes freezer locker plants would freeze their own products and sell them to consumers at a lower price than the grocery store frozen foods. You know, I think some of this culture still exists because used to have a local butcher I would go to. And besides selling their own meats fresh, they also sold their own frozen meats. And they also had packaged frozen vegetables for sale, along with other products that could go with your dinner and dairy products. So it was very interesting little shop. Especially, I thought the frozen vegetables was interesting. Frozen meat proved to be more popular than fresh, according to a study in North Carolina in 1943. In this article from the Durham Morning Herald from September 1943, it states, at the annual meeting of the Victory Freezer Locker in Bennington, Vermont, we learned that 58 tons of meat, vegetables, fruits, poultry, eggs, etc. had been preserved during the year. Most of this tonnage was meat. Certainly, this method of preserving foods will help in the war effort. There are over 300 stockholders in this cooperative. The farmer, who has a meat animal injured any time of the year, does not sell it for any price now. He butchers the animal and stores the meat in his locker, providing he is lucky enough to own freezer locker space. And that's something that I found, is that these freezer lockers were definitely in high demand and there were long waiting lists. Another thing about freezing for the war effort was that it was faster and easier than canning, but still bolstered food supplies for winter. In the Charlotte Observer from North Carolina, dated 9th of August, 1942, it says, standard-sized lockers hold around 200 pounds of foods. Some already are filled to overflowing. A typical locker contains 23 broilers, 15 pounds of sirloin steaks, several containers of strawberries, 10 or 15 pounds of shelled lima beans, a bushel of string beans, 3 dozen ears of corn. These tempting foods, ready for cooking and packaged in sizes to suit the family, will come in mighty good next winter, especially with growing war scarcities. And finally, the freezer locker plants were a vital war industry. From the Coronet that I referenced earlier, the magazine, it says, the strategic materials in 3 average-sized automobiles will completely equip a plant to serve 1,000 people. On a countrywide scale, these Victory Locker plants, stripped to bare essentials, reduce civilian demand for goods packaged in precious tin, decentralize food storage in the event of air attack, and release transportation facilities. Already, an estimated 75,000 freight car loadings have been shunted from food carrying to other war essentials as a direct result of local locker plant storage. Around the time that filling station attendants and rubber tire dealers began to seek other employment, locker operators resigned themselves to becoming a military casualty too. Now, Uncle Sam is telling them they're too valuable to scrap. They're running the only bank in the world that is solvent when its assets are frozen. I think this paragraph illustrates a few interesting points. One is that it's a very good point about decentralizing food storage in the event of air attack. So instead of it being held in a large freezing warehouse, the food was distributed among the country in these smaller freezer locker plants. And that's a really good point. And then this other thing of saying 75,000 freight car loadings have been shunted from carrying food to other war essentials because of local locker plant storage. That's amazing. Just that direct impact of freezing food locally. It's a good thing that the government realized how important this frozen food industry was and that they were working to support them despite the building shortages and the steel shortages so that people could preserve food. Many people felt that freezing food was easier and better than canning, which I also find very interesting because most of the propaganda and other cookbooks and things out there, they definitely promote canning. I've never seen anything promoting the frozen food industry. So not that people didn't can because of the frozen food lockers, but they definitely used, vital war materials for canning too. So this is a very interesting aspect of freezer locker plants that is important to highlight. Now, we're going to move on to the education of frozen food and its use, because this was still a fairly new industry not everyone knew how to cook with frozen foods or how to properly freeze foods. And there were some foods they were finding that didn't freeze as well as others. And so it's kind of a fun time to look at this industry because they were learning these things and, you know, how they were making their discoveries. So in order to educate, you know, they had basic tips in newspapers and magazine articles. So back to Miss Allen of the Kansas State College Extension Service, she taught that there were at least four general rules that all locker patrons needed to remember. One was that they should only use varieties of fruits and vegetables that are adapted for freezing. Freezing does not improve the quality of the food. Two, they should use only recommended containers and wrappings. These containers must be vapor-proof and moisture-proof. This was very important. I don't know if you've ever had something in the freezer that has absorbed other flavors in there. It's not nice to eat. Number three, preparing the food for storage so that it most nearly retains its original quality. For this reason, it is important that the food is gathered for freezing when it is at the desired stage of ripeness. And four, the family that uses the locker all year will be the most satisfied with it. If it is used for storing fruits, vegetables, and meat to its capacity each month, it will give good returns. So, I mean, you got to use it. If you've got the freezer locker, you need to be going out there, getting the foods, bringing them back home and eating them, and then filling it again to make the best use of your locker. They also held local classes. I found this account in the Daily News Journal from Tennessee, dated January 1942. The College of Agriculture of the University of Tennessee offered a freezer locker short course in January of 42. It was aimed primarily at locker operators, owners, and patrons, and covered the basic principles of frozen food processing and storage, but anyone was open to attend and learn about freezing food. They taught a lot of different classes, but here are the ones that applied more to the consumers. Freezing and storage of dairy products, preservation of eggs by freezing, production of fruits and vegetables, varieties of fruits and vegetables for freezing, preparation and storage of fruits and vegetables, packaging frozen foods for storage and transportation, chemistry of foods, nutrition, bacteria and sanitation, cooking and serving frozen foods in the home, and the housewife and her locker. In Texas, home demonstration agents held numerous demonstrations to show the correct preparation of fruits and vegetables. So these local classes were really important in educating the community in how to properly use frozen foods and how to properly store them. And even before that, processing them. As I was doing my research for this episode, I came across something I was not expecting to find, but it is very important to add to our discussion. And that is about home freezer plants or cabinets. Freezer plants for homes mostly catered to farms and were usually stored in the basement. They were really large, similar to chest freezers, but they did come in different sizes. It was ideal in that you didn't have to go to the freezer locker plant, but no doubt they drew a lot of power and they were very expensive to purchase. Home freezers cost at least $250. In 1940s money, and only a handful of people could afford them. A freezer locker cost a fraction of that for a small yearly fee. But there were enough people using these that it did make a significant difference. There was an account in the magazine, one of my new favorite magazines that I've discovered, Electricity on the Farm. And this is from the August 1942 issue. And it was written by Mrs. Wadsworth G. Flyer. And this is a very interesting story about home freezer cabinets. The Flyer family was not a typical farming family. They had moved from the city 5 years previous to the article being published. And as it states in the introduction, they have been learning to farm by study and experience. This kind of sounds like a lot of people that are trying out homesteading today. For Mrs. Flyer, canning had been such a problem for their family that she was worried about trying anything new. But when she heard about farm freezers, despite the sizable investment, she and her husband decided to investigate getting one for their home preservation needs. So they did research. They even called a farming family who had one and who were very enthusiastic about theirs. They looked into different models with the best cork insulation, going so far as to getting a check meter from their electric company to see how efficient it was after they bought their freezer. So her first project was freezing raspberries in a 50% sugar syrup and packing them in cardboard containers. She says, "It was a simple task to wash the berries, fill the containers, and pour on the syrup, leaving an inch space at the top of each container for expansion. My husband and 11-year-old daughter packed a case of 24 pints of raspberries in 22 minutes. It was a profitable undertaking." She even does a cost breakdown of the berry cost, sugar cost, and pint container cost versus the retail value of frozen berries at the time that they consumed them. The total savings was $14.91. So those are some very compelling results. I think another interesting part of this part of the story is that her husband and her 11-year-old daughter were able to do this task in such a short period of time. I think canning can be quite dangerous just because of the hot liquids and boiling water involved. Children aren't always able to be involved in many aspects of canning. But with freezing, like preparing foods for freezing, that's quite a different story. They also froze vegetables from their garden, including corn, string beans, wax beans, lima beans, broccoli, cauliflower, Swiss chard, blackberries, blueberries, raspberries, and many other vegetables and fruits, along with beef, lamb, and pig. They even experimented with freezing apple cider, which they enjoyed several months later, and it tasted just as sweet. She explains that her family preferred the flavor and look of frozen foods better than canned. They even saved the cardboard containers to use again as a cost savings. She says, "We did our usual amount of canning last year, and this gave us a direct comparison between the labor involved in quick freeze and canning. From our records, we have found that on the average, it takes 50% less time to process for quick freezing than to can. Also, we have had no failures or spoilage of quick frozen foods, while we have had many in canning." Now, I realize this is her experience. Not everyone necessarily had problems with canning, but I don't know how good the seals were for these jars, how many of the jars would go bad on average. Like, maybe that was just part of the aspect of canning, so you would expect some to go bad. I don't know about that, so that's something to just consider. But for her, quick freezing was the best way to preserve food. Two last things that they froze was fat and ice cream. She says, "In 1941, we saved 150 pounds of fat from hogs and beef and bought 100 pounds of butter at 39 cents per pound." And now this was before rationing. She continues, "We also purchased 150 quarts of ice cream at bulk prices, saving 15 cents per quart over retail prices, or a total of $22.50. So the fact that they froze fat and ice cream was pretty forward thinking. In all the other articles that I've encountered that talk about these freezer lockers, they never talk about freezing the fat. I also wonder, in my eighth episode of my podcast, where I talk about the National Pantry Census, I wonder if this affected them, you know, if they counted the things in their freezers, especially when it comes to the fat and the butter. And if that affected how many ration points that they received. I mean, they wouldn't have needed them because they had all this food in storage. So anyway, interesting to think about. They loved freezing foods so much that they froze foods until their unit was full. Then they moved the contents to a public locker plant and filled up their unit again. Even though the trip to the locker plant was 60 miles, they still thought it was worth it to increase their frozen food supply. And in 1942, they bought a second 26 cubic foot freezer. Wow, they love this technology, don't they? In closing, she states, "With the present shortage of sugar, rubber canning rings, jars, and other necessities for preserving food, this freezing method is a lifesaver. Berries, for instance, can be frozen, and made into jelly, jam, or pies at any time of the year when sugar may be available. We keep frozen pies, biscuits, donuts, bread, and rolls in our freezer. They are just like fresh when defrosted. We also freeze frankfurters so that we can have them for a picnic on a minute's notice. Our frozen homemade fresh sausage is delicious, and the bacon and fresh ham keeps much better in the freezer. When I make a quantity of cottage cheese, I store some of it in pint jars in the freezer to be used when the cow is dry. Our cracked eggs are taken out of the shell and put in paper containers during the low price season and used when the price of even cracked eggs is high. Wow, I find her super inspirational. My freezer game is nothing compared to hers. And, you know, for me, it's just part of my everyday life. I take it for granted. But here she is just going all in on this freezing technology. Now, some might think, oh, she's just like an old-fashioned version of a prepper, but I would disagree. This family was using the freezing technology of the day to save time and money, and when she met with a lot of frustration and failures with canning, freezing food was, like she said, a lifesaver in feeding her family economically. Yeah, I really do find her story so inspiring, and I keep thinking about the time during the pandemic when canning lids and pectin were scarce. A lot of us could have learned a thing or two from this woman's freezer game. There was a report out of a Texas newspaper in 1944, the Wichita Falls Record News, that said in their state, 137 home freezer units were in operation. 23,925 pounds of food was being stored in them, in addition to the 2,898,200 pounds of food in commercial freezers. So, I mean, these home freezer units really were making an impact, even though smaller than the, you know, the freezer locker plants, they still were super vital to the food preservation. As a final note about home freezer plants from Electricity on the Farm in the April 1942 issue, it says, to us, a farm freezer cabinet is another piece of electrical equipment that is no more of a luxury on a farm than the household refrigerator is today. It saves food costs and gives us high price cuts of meats, which ordinarily we would consider we could not afford. It is a means to make full utilization of all foods grown on the farm. It gives one a continuous supply of farm products, pork in the summer, strawberries and sweet corn in December, and so on. The preparation of food is cut to a minimum, and as far as we can see, there is no spoilage like that often occurs when things are canned. Ah, another note on that. Finally, it maintains the quality of food products. So while this is talking about home freezer cabinets, this is what could really be said for freezer locker plants too, just the freezing food technology in general. Looking to the post-war times, they were looking to those times. There was still wartime, but they saw frozen food as the future. The war had definitely given frozen food lockers a boost, but they were definitely there to stay, and they foresaw huge growth after the war. One article, the Fort Payne Journal in Alabama, dated December 1944, gave three reasons that frozen food was there to stay: necessity, nutrition, and economy. The necessity was that after the war, the U.S. was going to be busy feeding itself and helping to feed a lot of war-recovering countries. Not a lot of imports would be coming in. For nutrition, World War II had taught the U.S. a lot about the importance of nutrition, and a freezer locker plant, quote, enables its members to enjoy fresh fruits, vegetables, meats, and poultry through all the year. And finally, economy. There was a higher rate of loss in home butchering versus getting your meat from a freezer locker. It also eliminated unnecessary feeding of livestock from their butchering time until, you know, the weather was right. Additionally, the article goes on to explain that of the average retail food dollar, 61 cents is spent for processing, distribution, storage, transportation, and profit. Freezer lockers reduce this expense to 12 cents on the dollar. In conclusion, I found this really great kind of look into the future that was written in the Charlotte Observer in August 1942. So this was even at the beginning of the war. And they're looking at how frozen food is the wave of the future. It says, it is 1950. A Charlotte Meat Market's phone rings. I want a quarter of beef, a porker, a lamb, and 50 fryers, Mrs. Charlotte housewife says. Does the market man figure he's got a screwball on the phone? Some person with a Henry VIII appetite suffering from delusions of grandeur? Not at all. He'll likely recognize his customer as one of the increasing number of Mecklenburgers who since the end of World War II have been buying their meats, fruits, and vegetables in large quantities and freezing them for future use. Designed for the future? Assuredly. But unless men who know the food freezing business are wrong, the freezer locker and the home food freezer, already popular in Tennessee and parts of the West, will have a tremendous effect on the food industry in this section soon after the war ends and the necessary refrigeration equipment can be purchased. So like I said, they saw this technology as the food preservation method of the future. And boy, were they right. Frozen food preservation would not only grow in popularity after the war, frozen food as a staple in American kitchens would become an icon of the 1950s and 60s cuisine. You know, think frozen TV dinners. Refrigerators, freezer compartments would grow in size. Home chest freezers would improve in technology and reduce in price. Fast forward to today, where the new hot trend is freeze drying. I remember as a kid when that was the wave of the future, it was astronaut food. Frozen food is still very much a huge part of our American food landscape, and the food preservation urgency of World War II helped push us in that direction. So as soon as I posted this episode, I think I'm going to go grab a couple frozen pizzas to celebrate with a tub of our favorite ice cream, and I invite you to join me with your favorite frozen food. For this episode's cookbook feature, we're going to be looking at June Frost's recipe book from Fabius Farm Storage. This was a complimentary recipe book that was given to its patrons, and it's got a Christmas theme. The cover has pine trees and a Christmas star with a little snowy church and a village in the background. A big Christmas wreath in the front that says, "May we say Merry Christmas with June Frost's recipe book." And then underneath is a picture of a building that says Frozen Food Lockers on it. So it is a really fun little book. I was very excited when I found it because this is specifically frozen food locker plant recipe book, which I've never seen before. Inside, the book has kind of an introduction, and I read some of the parts of the cookbook, you know, in the rest of my episode. And so they, you know, make their case that frozen foods is better and that you can do so much with them, and how important it is for wartime. It says, "Now in wartime, the locker plant is as important to the national economy as to that of the individual. By processing locally grown foods and making them available for later use in the community in which they are produced, the locker plant saves much transportation by eliminating the hauling from the point of production to a distant processing center and back to the consumer. Two, because of locker plants, many foodstuffs that would otherwise be wasted are saved for use." So definitely promoting, you know, the wartime importance of their industry. You know, why not? It's their book. It also has a section on how to use locker meats. So a little bit of education. Also how to cook the frozen meats. And then they have, you know, other recipes in here. They have meat, and then they have another section on fish. They have one for preparing frozen fowl, preparing vegetables, preparing fruits for the locker, and then delicious desserts with frozen foods. So in each of these sections, they kind of give a little education, and then they have recipes as examples. It's quite a neat little book. I tried two recipes that my lovely Patreon patrons voted on. The first one is meatloaf. Now, at first glance, it's like, oh, meatloaf, you know, just the standard American fare. But this is a little bit special. It uses 1 pound of frozen ground beef, 1/2 pound frozen pork sausage, a 1/4 pound ground bacon. And then it's got salt, pepper, breadcrumbs, 2 eggs, chopped celery, a minced onion, 1/2 cup milk, and then 6 slices more of bacon. So the bulk of the meatloaf are all of those things, but the 6 slices of bacon are what's used to line the pan that you put the meatloaf into. So when I saw this, I was like, oh my gosh, this is just meat heaven, especially with the bacon and pork. And it was delicious. And I have seen in other wartime meatloaf recipes that they put either barbecue sauce or a ketchup on the top, which is how my family enjoys it, is with ketchup, because then it reduces the ketchup and it's a really delicious topping for meatloaf. And that's, I think, pretty classic. This doesn't call for that at all, but I just put the ketchup on there anyway because my family just prefers that. However, what I did find about this meatloaf, besides it being very moist and delicious, is that it was salty. I don't think you need 1.5 teaspoons of salt for this recipe, especially because it has frozen pork sausage and bacon, ground bacon in there. Now, I don't know if I'm assuming there's salt in this pork sausage that they're talking about and the bacon. So I just found that our meatloaf was far too salty. So reducing it to 1/2 teaspoon, maybe. And then you can always add salt later if you feel like it needs more salt. I just feel like it was overkill. I also, because in my experience of making meatloaf, it can be really greasy and it's cooking in a lot of its own fats. And then it was also lined with bacon to mitigate some of that fat. I actually did swap out the pork sausage for turkey sausage, and that made it much leaner. So if you don't want to go that route, you can always use a leaner ground beef. It's just a lot of fat, especially with the bacon and the pork sausage. So just kind of keep that in mind. You need to, like, try to find that right balance for you if you try this recipe. But otherwise, it was delicious. The second recipe that I tried was ice cream pie. Now, this was a very straightforward pie. Very easy. All it consists of is 1 rich pie shell, and that's just like a pastry pie shell, 1.5 cups of frozen berries, vanilla ice cream, and then whipped cream. So you just bake the pie shell according to the standard recipe. They don't even give you the recipe. And then when ready to serve, you fill the shell with ice cream that is not too hard, cover it with berries, and top with the whipped cream. And this makes a delicious dessert. Well, I mean, and you could theoretically have, like the woman that I talked about earlier, Mrs. Flyer, she froze her pastry shells. So, I mean, theoretically, you could even use a frozen pie shell and then bake it. But I decided to go the cookie crust route. And cookie crusts were authentic to wartime. They were popular for, you know, different kinds of pies. I thought in this case, my family would enjoy eating it more if it was a cookie crumb pie. So I used graham crackers and just made a standard graham cracker crust shell and then filled it with the ice cream and frozen berries and then whipped cream, of course. Now, because it's wartime, whipped cream might be difficult to come by. So there are ways to, you know, there are substitutions that could be made. There's always like ready whip, and then there's ways of whipping evaporated milk and all kinds of things to explore if you want to go down that road. So that was that pie. Super easy and very delicious. I will have these recipes on my Substack post if you would like to give them a try. And I mean, I recommend them. They're quite delicious. This episode's story highlight, or which I think I might change the name to Homefront Highlight. How does that sound? I like alliteration. Is from an article in my now beloved Electricity on the Farm magazine. It's called Our Experience with a Farm Freezing Cabinet by Eloy A. Adams and Joseph H. Bodwell. And this was from the April 1942 issue. This relates to the experience of the two authors, Mr. Adams and Mr. Bodwell, of using a farm freezing cabinet. They say, "For a long time, we have believed that a great deal of cash outlay from the farm could be saved if more foodstuffs could be raised and kept on the farm. During the last 2 years, the Extension Service has made an effort to encourage people in rural areas to do just this thing. Why should a farmer practically give away his veal calves or sell a cow to a dealer and then go to town and buy a portion of the same animal or a similar one at 3 times the selling price? But how to preserve the meat kept on the farm?" He says, "Lots of folks raise a hog or two, the custom being to kill them in cold weather, salt the pork, cure the shoulders and hams, and then eat fresh pork morning, noon, and night until the hog is consumed and everyone is tired and sick of seeing a piece of the meat around." And it was for these reasons that they became interested in the farm freezer cabinet and bought one the previous year. So they got theirs in 1941. Theirs measured 93 inches by 35 inches by 36 inches high. Inside had 2 compartments that were 4.25 cubic feet that was equipped with a small fan, and a storage compartment of 24.5 cubic feet. For this size of cabinet, they say that 200 pounds of prepared products could be put into the freezer compartment at one time. The storage compartment held about 900 pounds of frozen foods, and with the fan going, freezing went to negative 10 degrees Fahrenheit or lower within 8 hours. So they tell a really funny story in this article. It's really about them kind of experimenting and learning about freezing food technology with this freezer unit. And there's this really funny story of this mishap. Like they slaughtered a cow and then they cut some of it, you know, into pieces, so that was, you know, more manageable to package and freeze. But then they had this entire cow hindquarter left, so they just wrapped it and like stuck it in the freezer as it was because they thought, you know, we'll just cut it up later. Well, they tried to do that. They tried to cut it with small saws without any luck. The saws got gummed up until finally they had success with a cross-cut wood saw, but unfortunately when you use that type of a saw, they lost like 1/4 inch of meat for every cut. So, and there's even a picture of them like hacking away at it with a saw on this table. So sad. But they learned a very hard lesson that day, that you just need to break down the meat completely and never to freeze like a whole part of a cow like that. Another problem was that after wrapping the meats and other things in paper, all the cuts looked the same. So they learned quickly the importance of labeling. I don't know if you've done this. I know I've done this where I'm like, oh yeah, I'll remember this, what this is later. I stick it in a container into the freezer, and then later I'm like, what the heck is this? And when it's frozen, it's really hard to tell. You have to thaw it out to find out. Another funny aspect of this learning curve was that when they'd have visitors over, they had fun with the novelty of dropping the parcels of meat to hear the noise, which sounded like rocks. But the downside was that it tore the paper. So after that, they put stockinette wrappings over all their paper parcels. I find this hilarious because, you know, it's such a novelty still at this point to have this frozen technology and just being able to, like, drop the packages and hear the sound. I just find that really funny. And I can, you know, see it in my mind. But I also was thinking, like, did they drop one on their toe? Because I've heard of terrible things happening when you drop like a full turkey on your toe. It's not good. So I hope they were okay. They also experimented with freezing vegetables in brine in glass jars and learned how delicate the glass was once it was frozen. They couldn't fill it too much or bump them around because they'd shatter. They had good success with chicken livers and gizzards in glass jars, though. And at that point in the article, they almost exclusively used cardboard boxes. Some were round, some square, for packing anything with a liquid. So their adventures in experimenting with freezing foods in a new, to them, technology was amusing and refreshing. They say, to date, we have put into this cabinet 2 cows, 1 veal, 2 sheep, 1 hog, 200 pounds of chicken and asparagus, raspberries, peas, blueberries, string beans, sweet corn, tomatoes, peaches, cauliflower, and melons. A total of over 2,000 pounds in 8 months. Wow. And just think of all that food they are preserving that is not coming from the grocery store, saving food for others and lessening the burden on the wartime food system in general. All right, well, that's it for this episode. I hope you enjoyed learning about this really interesting aspect of food preservation in wartime. That's really not talked about very much. If you'd like to follow me on Instagram, I post a bunch on there. Not so much, not as often. I'm trying to cut back a little bit just for sanity's sake. But I am posting more on Substack. I've got regular, my regular posts for the podcast go there. And then I do occasionally post other articles for my subscribers on there. So you can follow me on Substack. The link is victorykitchenpodcast.substack.com. And if you're interested in Patreon, I have done a little updating on my tiers, and I would love your support there. It helps, you know, my wonderful patrons are such a great support to me and my work here. And I especially want to give a shout out to my Patreon member, Amy, for all of her support. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye.